I'm Chris Preston.
And I'm Brad Zimmerman.
And welcome to Street Check, the best podcast in Cabot Wealth Network history for 2 years running now. We made it to year two, Brad. That's something that freaks and geeks, Urban Meyer and George Santos can't say. Not bad, huh?
Yeah, we're in good company, apparently.
Freaks and Geeks, good show. Okay, so 2024, you know, we had come on here initially just to generally talk about our thoughts on the market, but it's been an eventful week for the market. Brad, tell people about what the rundown is for today.
All right, so up this week, we've got Bruce Kayser of Cabot Value Investor in the Cabot Turnaround Letter. He's going to come on to talk about his thoughts for the market going forward. We're also going to do a market wrap up of 2023 and a little bit of a look ahead to 2024. We're going to talk about the election year, which could be good or it could be terrible. We'll see how that conversation goes. And then we're going to see if we can identify some candidates for sort of this year's big narrative. So last year we had AI, ChatGPT, and we had the weight loss drugs, the GLP-1 category of drugs. We're going to offer up some candidates for what we think could maybe be that this year.
All right. And as always, we'll start with the Defend the Take. And Brad, you're up this time. You get to kick off the year. And your take is about something that maybe people are trying to avoid this month. Beer. You think beer companies will be down double digits this year. Beer company stocks will be down double digit percentage this year. You have 90 seconds. Explain yourself.
So you actually kind of hit the nail on the head with the reference to dry January up top, mm-hmm. right? Dry January, people trying to be more health conscious, trying to avoid drinking. It's been a relatively recent trend, but what has been sort of masked coming out of the pandemic years is that that recent trend is actually part of a much larger trend of people reducing alcohol consumption, oftentimes in favor of cannabis or low or no alcohol alternatives. And I think what we've missed with the beer companies specifically, the big macro brewers are all relatively flat in the last 5 years, with the exception of Constellation Brands, which is STZ. They're up about 55% in the last 5 years, mostly on market share gains. But I think what we've done is we've looked at the pandemic and seen declining volumes there because people can't go out, you're not seeing your friends, et cetera. Anheuser-Busch, InBev, Bud, BUD is the ticker symbol. Obviously, they had their boycotts, their issues with their marketing choices last year. And I think what that's doing is it's explaining away what is a longer-term trend as these short-term fluctuations. We've actually seen beer volumes decline by 2% a year going back to 2017. Obviously, some of that is going to be a result of that short-term narrative. But people are reassessing their relationships with alcohol, especially younger generations. And we're more health conscious now than we have been in the 20 years prior. And one thing that we're seeing out of actual companies' earnings is they're pointing to inflation pricing pressures, allowing them to raise prices, and something they're calling premiumization. So despite 2% annual volume declines, Heineken...
Keep going. What's
your point? Heineken came out, they beat earnings, or they had higher revenues because they were able to point to higher dollar sale amounts. Cannabis tax revenues are higher in states with legalized cannabis than in states than the alcohol tax take is. So I think that this is the year that those short-term trend explanations sort of drop off, and we actually see the impact of a healthier consumer that's deprioritizing alcohol consumption. Bad news for the brewers.
Okay. Yeah, I hadn't taken a look at what's
not
that?
The Milwaukee Brewers, the brewing companies.
Oh, yeah, similar downward trend. I hadn't really looked at beer stocks lately. I'm part of the dry January movement. This is like my sixth year running. My wife and I have done it. We know a lot of people here who do it too. So just anecdotally, but that's 1 month, obviously. I think that you might be onto something with the shift from, it hasn't happened yet with cannabis stocks, but, you know, shift in just from alcohol to cannabis in some cases. And, you know, people who are going dry might be, you know, might be increasing in other areas, increasing their, you know, adopting a different vice. You know, whether they're correlated in the market, who knows? I think cannabis is totally its own thing, but
there's a trend out here. I'm curious if the term has reached you, California sober or Cali sober.
No.
That's no alcohol. Yes. Marijuana. But I think that, as you said, anecdotal, the dry January thing is anecdotal, but I think that what they are is actually an indicator of maybe a larger trend of deprioritizing the alcohol consumption in favor of stuff that's healthier. I mean, we see how much momentum the GLP-1 stocks, right, like the weight loss drugs, and we'll get into that a little bit later, how much they've moved. And they're not moving because everybody's doctor is saying you have to lose weight. It's conscientiousness on the part of consumers. And I think that these declining volumes have been sort of hiding under smaller trends that are easier to explain away for the industry.
No, that's a good take. Okay, let's move on to our big three. Like you said, we'll start with the market. It's, you know, down first week for the market, all it's up today. It seems to like the jobs numbers that came in above expectations. It was four straight days down. S&P was down about 2% from its, no, this is from, you know, all-time highs that it barely touched it at the end of December. Down 2%, NASDAQ closer to, you know, 3.5-4%. Some growth funds are more like 4-6%, equal weight 2% is down. Should we read anything into what's happened this week? I know there's like the whole Santa Claus rally thing. If, you know, the market's up in the, what was it, the 3 days after Christmas and the
five trading days after Christmas.
Five trading, like the last three days of December, first couple, or however the calendar falls, I guess. But right. Then the market tends to be up. Obviously, that not the case this year. I don't really give that too much credence. Just big picture, do you find anything concerning about what's happened the first week of the year?
You know, not much. I think we have been very vocal about the sort of repositioning away from the big leaders from last year. Mike Santolo of Growth Investor wrote a daily article for us that ran today, where he highlighted some thoughts on this sort of recent little mini sell-off. And his big takeaway was, yeah, it's kind of yellow flags, but nothing really out of the ordinary. January tends to have a lot of cross currents. So you've got repositioning ahead of the new year, where companies are taking capital gains on some of their super high flyers because they've got a new year ahead of them. They're not worried about capital gains at the end of last year. So they've got all year to sort of manage for that. And then doing what we're going to try and do, which is position into what could potentially be leading sectors or leading industries going forward. And, you know, we'll get to that when we talk about the election year thing, but it's seasonal, or it's historically a meh kind of year. I don't think we've got the sort of Damocles hanging over our heads by any means. But I do think that people are going to be repositioning and maybe looking for trades with more juice left in them than the mega cap, the Magnificent Seven stocks have after such a strong year.
I figured, regardless of the calendar, once you hit all-time highs and on the kind of strength we saw, you know, broad market strength we saw in November and December, a pullback was inevitable. And I think the flipping of the calendar is an easy excuse for people to go in the other direction, at least temporarily, just like we saw after, you know, bear market in 2022. Start of last year, January was good. January and February were really good. And, you know, granted that turned into a full-fledged rally. Well, actually it really didn't until just a couple months ago. But I think a pullback was to be expected. And the fact that it's January, beginning of the year, means less than it may seem. I think it's just
yeah, there's a window dressing element too, where fund managers want to be able to say, oh yeah, if you look at our Q4 reporting, yeah, we were in Nvidia, we were in Microsoft, we were in all these hot growth stocks at the end of the year. So obviously, you know, we'll be in the hot growth stocks when our Q1 report, when our Q1 holdings come out, or when our later holdings come out. So the idea being that they would then find something that's going to perform better going forward. So there's an incentive to sort of hold it through the end of the year. And then some of the tax gains stuff that I had mentioned previously, but I'm not reading too much into this. It's certainly not enough to spook me.
Yeah. And as Mike wrote this morning, you know, intermediate to long-term trends are still very much up, even in growth stocks, which have, you know, been hit harder this week. So one down week does not, you know, yellow flag, sure, but it's not a cause for major concern yet. Okay, let's go to just the sort of the full year outlook for the market and tie that into, like you said, the election. It's an election year. Those tend to be not the best year for stocks. We just come off the third year of a new election or of a presidential term tends to be the best year. And, you know, that sort of just played out. S&P up nearly 25% this year. The average gain in the S&P since 1949 is 13%, so that's pretty good. And the last three elections, so this shows you the market does not care which party wins. Up 18.4% in 2020, Biden. Up 12% in 2016, Trump. Up 16% in 2012, Obama re-election. What we do see is uncertainty and sort of complacency leading up to the election. So like late August, last two elections, late August until late October, early November, the market has been either flat or down a little bit. And then as soon as the election was over, it took off. Happened in 2016, happened in 2020. I think that's something we're more likely to see. You know, I think what our expectations are for the year align with what usually happens in a presidential election year is that, you know, up double digits, but probably not, you know, the world beating returns that we saw last year. But obviously that was heavily influenced by the Magnificent Seven. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, the Stock Traders Almanac, which is where I think most people would be familiar with the presidential election sort of cycle, refers to the election years as mediocre on average.
Yeah,
that largely aligns with what my expectations would be. I mean, you think about if we had the Fed rate hike cycle, we had inflation that was through the roof. I mean, unless it comes out of left field, I can't imagine anything that's going to be perceived more negatively than what we had last year in 2024. And the fact that we were able to generate strong returns in the NASDAQ, strong returns in the S&P, and yep, strong, if more muted, returns in the Dow would point to higher prices down the road to me. There's still a ton of cash on the sidelines. In excess of, I think, $6 trillion in money market funds. Some of that is going to be gobbled up by companies that need it for operating costs now that interest rates are still higher, although those are likely to come down. So there's certainly a possibility that companies that were maybe worried about having working capital going out a year or two or 3 years into the future are less worried about that and would spend commensurately. But, you know, absent a black swan, I don't really see anything that comes out of nowhere to shock the market and really crush us. I know there's still plenty of perma bears out there that are saying, you know, we've got 60% or 80% corrections coming. Commercial real estate, not great, but doesn't seem likely to trickle through to equity markets and to really hammer most investors.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, in terms of, you know, election cycles specifically, there's going to be a whole lot more noise. Obviously, you know, doom and gloom. If so and so wins this, you know,
yeah,
expect this. Yeah, I don't know what impact it has on the same two guys likely, who just were the last two presidents sitting and previous presidents running. I don't think we've had that in my lifetime. I don't know what impact that has. Maybe even makes it less uncertain because we know they've been president before. Barring something, you know, happening in the Republican primary, obviously, that's unexpected.
I've always heard that Wall Street likes gridlock, right? Like if you've got mixed parties in there, you've got one party in the presidency, one controlling the Senate, the other controlling the House, or whatever the exact breakdown is. You tend to have legislative gridlock, which is generally good for business because that means you don't have new regulations coming in. People can continue to sort of spend freely. Obviously, if we get prolonged government shutdowns or if anything like that happens, there's too much foot dragging. There could be negative consequences. But gridlock in a super partisan and noisy election season seems good for Wall Street, generally speaking.
You take Washington out of the equation, it's one big thing, one less big thing you have to worry about. Okay, let's move on to something, our number three in our big three, some topic a little bit more fun than presidential election is candidates to be this year's AI and, you know, smaller scale was the GLP one, the weight loss drugs, namely Eli Lilly with Mounjaro and Novo Nordisk with Ozempic and Wegovy, sort of an out of nowhere new trend industry that takes off and becomes mainstream and drives certain stocks. So that one drove mostly two stocks, but AI is the thing that really lifted all boats and gave us a summer rally, and, you know, was still a big driver of the rally we saw the end of the year and to today. Is there something you see? This is a bit of a silly question because the part of the reason those things were such hits last year is because no one really saw them coming. And no one saw, people saw AI coming, but I don't think they saw it coming all at once like a freight train last year, the way it did after ChatGPT sort of launched it into the mainstream. And then the weight loss drugs, you know, that's definitely came more out of nowhere. So that element of surprise is part of what gives them sort of the wow factor and makes people want to jump on the trend. Do you see something, you know, knowing that it's hard to identify those trends before they happen, are there anything that you see that could be candidates for this year?
So I'll say a couple of things. The first one, in the daily in December of 2022, we picked Nvidia, Google, and Microsoft as the big winners of the AI race, right? Those were three of four. The other one that we identified was IBM. Even at that time, we wrote, the big thing right now is the growth stock sell-off, but if you're going to pick the next Google, pick one of these four. That ended up being right. All right. So I'm going to take a little bit of a big victory lap there, seeing that I eat hot sauce on a regular basis for being wrong.
Yeah, you gotta take them when you actually get them. Yeah, go for it.
So having maybe established a little bit of a bona fides there, you know, like you said, nobody saw it hitting like a freight train. I certainly didn't. I don't think anybody did. The GLP-1 thing, I think we all missed a little bit because it's not like these were newly developed drugs. These were drugs that existed for diabetes, and the documentation and the medical literature and even some of the off-label prescriptions showed that they were really effective for weight loss. We just all missed it. If we were all reading medical literature all the time, we could have picked those up. So looking for the thing that's going to be the next GLP-1 is probably already out there. It's probably, I mean, it happened with Viagra, right? That it was originally a heart condition medication or blood pressure medication. And then there was this off-label benefit. There's probably something that's out there right now that is being prescribed that is really effective for a common medical ailment that we're all just missing. That would be where I would look. But if you want to try and guess one, the antibiotic resistant bacteria, that is where my guess would be. Specifically, there's a compound that they just found to be effective against something called CRAB, which is I'll find it. Carpabenum resistant Acinetobacter baumannii. It's top of the WHO's list of antibiotic resistant.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. Antibiotic resistant pathogens back in 17. FDA and a new study just identified something called zozurabalpin. It's a chemical class that's really effective against that. So if I'm looking for the next GLP-1, I'm looking for something that treats antibiotic resistant bacteria. And it does appear that there's some promising headway there. I don't know even who would manufacture that. I know it's with Roche, was one of the researchers there, and Harvard University. That is probably where my emphasis would be, is somebody that's commercializing a treatment like that.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder what, like, the broad, it has to have like a broad hook, broad appeal, you know. I guess it depends on the way it's packaged. You know, the word bacteria, I think, would just give people, you know, ice cream headache.
Yeah.
Say.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, like, stuff like MRSA is really, really prevalent, really, really prevalent. You see people that get sick and, you know, and are unable to get effectively treated for things like that. It's being spread in hospitals. So I guess maybe it's a little bit more niche than I'm thinking. If we wanted to go bigger and higher profile, I'm going to go flying cars.
Yeah, I thought you had a flying saucers tech. Yeah, go for it.
All right. So there's Toyota Motors put $400 million behind a company called Joby that's working on flying car tech. XPeng is supposed to reach commercial stage production, although not mass production until next year. But they're supposed to be commercial production this year for their flying car. And these flying cars are industrial scale drones that are only really now possible because of lithium technology and the prevalence of, like, the quadcopter style drone. There are a ton of small companies that are working on bringing this technology to market. The obvious risks are they turn into just like rich guy hobby, or that there's a collision or an accident or something. But I do think that this is that the Olympics, where France will be moving people around on a volocopter or velocopter, I assume volocopter is the pronunciation. They're already set to move people around on this volocopter. It's a two-seat rotary drone style flying car. That's going to get a lot of visibility around the Olympics. So I think over the summer, we're going to start hearing a lot more people talking about how flying cars are a thing. And initially, they're going to be basically flying helicopter routes or getting you to and from airports. But I think it's going to tease enough people enough that there's going to be more investment into the space. And people are going to read about Honda working on it and Toyota and these partnerships with airlines. And I think that'll get a lot of public attention.
Yeah, see, that's one. There's a hook there. I mean, flying cars, that's, you know, it's easy for people to latch onto that. You know, feels like I'd be a little early, but, you know, if, like you said, all it takes is, you know, one company being close to actual production there, where it can really start to take off. But yeah, that's an interesting one. I don't have any specifically minor, you know, the things I'm interested in are nothing new. You know, we've talked about Chinese stocks being contrarian plays after having a rough couple of years, small caps after also rough couple of years. You know, I'm still holding out for cannabis, but I'll believe it when I see it. But I think that my just main thing is, like I said, part of the reason these things hit so hard is because most people didn't see them coming. Whatever it is, I think it's probably something that you and I don't see coming. If you nail the flying cars thing being a trend this year, I think that'll erase all you're exempt from the hot sauce challenge at the end of the year, or at least mid year.
Yeah, no, yeah. There's no fun in that. I'm not.
It negates one of your wrongs. Then how about that?
That's fair. No, I'm not. I mean, you can really never tell with this stuff. But yeah, you talk about China. It's like, okay, well, XPeng, right? They start selling these vehicles. They start going viral on social media. The news media picks it up and runs with it. And then all of a sudden it's everywhere and it's in super high demand. You can't, crystal balls are broken for a reason. And, right. And, but if I've got a, you know, if I'm going to pay the price for bad predictions, I'm also going to loudly proclaim hopefully good predictions.
Yeah. Mostly, well, yeah, your call on some of those mega caps from a year ago, that was a good one. So yeah, feel free to toot your own horn on that one. Okay. Let's bring in Bruce Kayser, our value investing expert here at Cabot, and we'll have Bruce join us in just a second. We welcome on Bruce Kayser, who is Cabot's chief analyst of the Cabot Value Investor and Cabot Turnaround Letter Advisories, longtime value investing expert. Bruce, welcome. I read your issue from earlier this week, where you talked about your outlook for 2024, which is something Brad and I have talked a lot about, but you were probably a better chance of being accurate, more accurate than we are. But your outlook kind of aligns with what we've been talking about. You said expect broadly for the S&P to produce about a 10% total return or in line with the historical average. But you don't see that being as Magnificent Seven driven as last year and for the other 493 to sort of pick up the slack a bit. Is that sort of what you're seeing going into this year?
Yeah. And again, thanks for being on the show here. It's always a pleasure to help talk about some of my ideas. Help you guys out. It's a fantastic podcast. So yeah, on the outlook, you know, I guess with all forecasts, you know, they'd be taken with a grain of salt. I think Warren Buffett once said the primary value of a stock forecast is to make
forecasts look better. Good,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's important to make one anyways, just to kind of get a sense of where, you know, one thinks the market's going to go, and knowing that it's going to be wrong, but at least you can put some markers out there and understand what might have happened and might not. So I think in a typical year, the stock market does produce about a 10% return. I see no reason to be either more optimistic or more pessimistic maybe than historically average. I think we've seen such a huge volatility driven by the Magnificent Seven stocks. 2022, they were just awful returns as they worked off some excessive valuation and priced in interest rate increases a little bit. And then in 23, they just took off, partly because of maybe being oversold or artificially cheap. You know, Meta, for example, is trading at like 8x earnings. That was just way too cheap for a really fantastic company. And then, you know, AI and the hope that interest rates would be cut really just led to a massive gain in those stocks. But the average stock, if you look at the S&P 500 equal weight, which weights all stocks equally, not weighted by market cap like the broad S&P 500. You know, that index was up about 14% last year, a good year for sure, but not the 27, 28% total return of the broad market. So I think we're probably going to have a pretty decent year. I don't expect great things out of the Magnificent Seven. You know, Apple's been in the news lately for being overpriced a lot. There's probably a lot of merit to that. But a lot of other stocks, I think, are in fine shape. If the economy stays reasonably strong here, I think that could be, you know, broadly, you know, industrials, maybe some consumer stocks, you know, broadly good names.
Yeah, you know, normally you would think with the market, you know, the market, at least the S&P, just sort of touched all-time highs at the end of December, although it's down this first week. Normally you'd think it's tough to find value in a market like that. But again, as you mentioned, it's really so driven by those seven stocks that, you know, I'm sure there's still a lot of value out there, right?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And I guess our approach is to look for value, you know, wherever we can find it. There's 505 stocks in the S&P 500. And then there's, you know, many hundreds more, 1,000 more, whatever, in the mid cap and small cap group. We right. certainly look there. And our approach is really to ignore the aggregates and look at the individual names to see where, for some reason or another, you know, one stock here, one stock there, have really just been sold off way too far based on what the fundamentals and the company really are worth. And, you know, there are always those kinds of stocks, and we're certainly finding those right now. And in some ways, the more the market leans in one direction, like at the end of last year, it was, we're going to get interest rate cuts, because the economy is slowing. We're going to have a recession, either a hard landing or soft landing, but we're going to have a landing of some kind, and maybe it will be hard. A lot of industrial stocks and economically sensitive consumer stocks are sold pretty hard. And so we're finding opportunities in some of those groups that, again, on a one-name basis here, one-name there, we think there's some pretty interesting opportunities.
Is there any sector in particular that has seemed oversold to you disproportionately? I mean, I know the emphasis is on individual names, but are you seeing that in a more pronounced effect in any particular sector?
Yeah, I get to thinking industrials seem to have some of the best opportunities right now. And a lot of times investors will look at industrials as, you know, the largest of industrial stocks. So we may not look at the biggest ones that sort of drive the overall average for, you know, the industrial sector, but we'll look at smaller cap or mid-cap names, or the ones that are on the smaller end of the S&P 500. And that's what some of the opportunities are. And again, a lot of investors have thought we're going to have a recession here in the U.S., you know, certainly a slowdown around the world. A lot of our industrial companies get earnings from around the world, so it would slow down their earnings growth. But a lot of these have been discounted too heavily based on what seems to be, you know, these fairly resilient growth and not a hard landing.
I'm curious, and I don't think we've ever talked about it before. What are your thoughts currently on China specifically, if you have any, just from a contrarian standpoint more than anything?
Yeah, and that's a question I get, you know, fairly often, being, you know, contrarian or value investor. A lot of the stocks broadly and individually in China have been sold very hard, and on some statistical measures seem pretty inexpensive. I do very little, if anything, directly with China. Indirectly, many of our companies have revenue and earnings in China. But my concern about the Chinese market, both from a financial and economic perspective, is it's still very heavily influenced by the top leadership at the government. That leadership can you know, make changes on a dime about what industries or sectors or whatever are in favor and out of favor. So it makes it hard to analyze sort of the long-term trends in the companies there. The economy seems to be struggling. There's a lot of issues with financial, too much debt. We've seen a couple major bankruptcies in the past 12 months. So I just find China to be somewhat impenetrable in terms of understanding the fundamentals, the companies. Maybe it's not, you know, Gap financials that I'm more familiar with. So I just tend to avoid China directly, and I'm worried about the indirect exposure of companies that have a lot of revenue over there, partly for sort of macro reasons and partly because it's a very competitive market over there. A lot of auto companies are finding that what used to be a great economy for, you know, Western car companies is now not so great because the local competition has gotten very intense. You know, very savvy. The cars that are being produced in China are very good now, and that means less market for both American car makers or European car makers, and also those that supply components to those manufacturers. So pretty leery about China directly and some indirect exposure there.
Sorry, Brad.
I want to say a quick note to anybody that is watching or listening that is not a subscriber of Cabot Value Investor. Bruce is skeptical of adjusted earnings, so everything he said about opacity from China, I should have predicted that was coming, that his inability to get accurate numbers would be a deal breaker for him.
Mm-hmm. Given, Bruce, that your focus, you know, is more on U.S. stocks, another contrarian play, Brad, I've talked about, and you mentioned earlier, you know, small mid-cap stocks. Small cap stocks have underperformed for 2 years, and historically, they outperform large caps. You know, I think Tyler London, who we had on a few weeks ago, our small cap expert, said that they outperform every three out of every 5 years, and well, they're down in the last 2 years. Are you looking more at small and mid caps now than you may have a couple of years ago, just given their underperformance of late?
Yeah, and certainly with the small caps, I've historically not looked at small caps too much, but I've started to look at them really over the past year, partly out of curiosity and partly because there were just some amazing bargains that right. you just would never find in mid and large cap space, companies that are, you know, doing perfectly fine, but investors look at them as really just, why bother if I can get a, you know, quote, guaranteed 20 or 30% return in, you know, some of the magnificent seven stocks. And so in some ways, similar to your 1999, when the dot-com stocks took off and everything else was thrown out, it was kind of similar and still a little bit now, where everybody wants the large cap, mega cap, growth tech stocks, and everything else is just being kind of thrown away. You know, just for perspective, Apple's market cap alone, I think, is bigger than the entire Russell 2000 index.
Right.
So that just leaves a phenomenal amount of intriguing opportunities. Again, it's really important to pick out, you know, the right individual stocks, because not all stocks are the same, and there's a lot of names in there that really we would never touch. But as those names are thrown out broadly, a lot of individual names start looking pretty attractive here that investors have just you know, more than overlooked, really just kind of discard out of hand.
Now, as I did not go through the 99 tech bubble. I was just getting out of high school at the time. I may not look it, but I'm still a young man. Would you be more concerned? Because so I really liked some of the more philosophical writing that you've done about, like, all right, well, if it's only seven companies, why ever buy anything else, right? Like that sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, but also very much staring at a train coming at you potentially. Would you be more concerned if you're a Magnificent Seven tech investor that we see antitrust enforcement start breaking some of these companies up, or that valuations catch up with them the way we saw in the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Again, with the Magnificent Seven, they're all seven, you know, in somewhat many different ways, different companies. Tesla and Apple are bunched in the same group of seven, but they're very, very different companies. But I think your question's a good one. You know, they're all kind of grouped in, partly because they're the biggest stocks in the index. The S&P 500 and a lot of stocks, or any money flowing into the S&P 500 has to buy those stocks in volume, and so you just get a push. But in some ways, these stocks are going up based on an extrapolation of the past. You know, wow, Apple's been a fantastic company. It's had a great run. Stock is, sure, it's kind of expensive, and it's a massive company. But we just think, gosh, great, everything's going to be good going in the future, and so we're just going to kind of ride the past into the future. And that's true for a lot of names, but you're right. Antitrust, all the headwinds that the companies are facing now weren't really there necessarily, you know, in the past. You know, it's interesting about artificial intelligence. Sure, in a broad view, these companies would benefit, but they could benefit way down the road. And over the next 1, 2, 3 years, it's pretty unlikely, possibly with the exception of NVIDIA, that these companies really will see much benefit from artificial intelligence at the ground level, earnings level, compared to the thematic support that investors have put on them for you know, their AI enthusiasm. And that's really a big difference in, a big similarity with the dot-com stocks. In many ways, investors were right. The internet was going to be a massive changer of everybody's lives and the industrial, or, you know, the earnings and industries and retail, all that stuff. You know, the internet has really revolutionized pretty much how everybody lives. So on a thematic basis, those investors are exactly right. But the stocks they picked were so overpriced that those expectations couldn't possibly have been met. Cisco is a great example. The stock was trading like 100 times earnings. It has yet to recover its 2000 high in terms of price, even though the earnings have marched along. Many of the stocks that were heavily favored in the dot-com bubble, you know, they don't exist anymore because their business model just wasn't quite, you know, where things were headed. So while the theme may be right, investors could easily lose half or all their money on some individual stocks because those companies just aren't really where their future's going, even though the theme may be right. And so that's where we look at valuation and fundamentals and try to make sure that we're buying something that's actually there or will be there, not something that, gee, it sounds great and may be there or maybe not.
I think from a practical standpoint, you really hit the nail on the head with that. I mean, if you think about a company like Google, they can't really command more market share of attention or eyeballs or search. It doesn't matter how good their AI offerings are. They already have the entirety of the market share of search on the internet, the majority of the market share of advertising on the internet. Even just setting aside valuations from a, the word is getting by me now, but from an incremental gain standpoint, they don't really have much more room. A company like a Google doesn't really have much more room to run. It's already effectively the internet.
Yeah, and history has pretty much unanimously or almost unanimously concluded that a company that wins in one tech era is not a winner in the next tech area. You know, Microsoft would be almost the sole exception of a company that was extremely successful going into, you know, the dot-com bubble and now has become extremely successful in sort of this era of technology. Most companies just cannot make that transition because, you know, in some ways they're just a one-trick pony that happened to do really well during the time when that trick was working well. Transitioning to a new technology or new revenue stream is historically really, really hard. You know, one interesting example is, you know, Apple Computer. Apple was given up for dead. It was trading almost at its cash balance in about 2005. So here's a company that, in some ways, was completely different by 2010. It invented a product that didn't exist, the iPhone, and took off. And in some ways, the iPhone put so many other companies out of business, but also the iPhone made Google. It made, in some ways, NVIDIA, and it made a lot of other companies, Amazon in some ways, you know, they exist in their present successful form, partly because of, you know, what Apple did. And that was unpredictable in 1999. So my guess is it's 2024 here. By 2026, 27, whatever, there may be some new technologies that we can't conceive of yet that will just make a lot of these companies that are the big winners today, you know, either irrelevant or certainly not the successful green lights to the end of time kind of companies that they appear to be now.
And Bruce, last time we had you, just sort of switching gears here, last time we had you on, you had just come from the annual, I think this is your first time going to the annual Berkshire Hathaway retreat in Omaha, right? Yeah, I can't remember when that was, last summer sometime maybe. And you had the chance to hear, I think, Charlie Munger speak then. He has since passed. What are your recollections of what you heard from him there and what you've sort of learned from him over the years?
Yeah, that was just a fantastic experience and kind of really lucky that I was able to go while both, you know, Buffett and Munger were around. And I think the kind of the big takeaway is that there's a phenomenal number of very, very loyal fans and loyal investors just kind of talking with people informally. You know, some had owned the stock for 20 or 30 years. Some apparently owned quite a bit of stock, but all were just very humble, kind people. And a fantastic sort of following that just reflects on the success both in the investing world and also just a philosophical view of things that a lot of people adopted and have done quite well. So it was just a great experience kind of being out there and absorbing all that. You know, as you're saying, a lot of people, you know, say, well, Buffett's really the, you know, the brains and everything behind it. But, you know, Munger very readily let Buffett have the stage. But in his own right, Munger was probably a much, much greater source of wisdom and knowledge and insight. And I think his influence on Warren Buffett is incredibly understated. You know, just one of the millions of things he said, one of the great quotes he had was, you know, along these lines where, you know, the long-term advantage of trying to be, you know, they have try to have a long-term advantage of trying to be consistently not stupid rather than trying to be very intelligent. And right. I mean, that kind of talks about his humility, but also it's a great way of looking at things. A lot of people try to be really smart and intelligent. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. But if you just try to be not stupid, you know, not make, you know, big blunders, you know, over time, that'll compound and create a much better return, however measured on whatever you're looking at. than it will be trying to be, cute or smart or whatever. And I thought that approach was just, really insightful and fantastic, maybe avoiding mistakes rather than, trying to hit those home runs.
Right. Yeah. I try not to be stupid every day. I don't know if I succeed, but
it's a challenge for all of us. Absolutely.
Not according to my wife. Brad, any last questions for Bruce before we let him go?
No, I appreciate the perspective. I always really enjoy the conversations, especially when it comes to stuff that maybe leans more philosophical than gets down into the dollars and cents of it. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you very much.
And by the way, I mentioned, Bruce runs our Cabot Value Investor and Cabot Turnaround newsletters. You can find them under the Premium Advisories tab on the CabotWealth.com website. If you're looking to subscribe, I believe this turnaround letter has handily beaten the market the last 3 years running. So if you want to hear more from Bruce, those are the places to find him. Bruce, again, thanks. And we'll be back next week with the next episode of Street Check. See you then.
Great. Thank you.